from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Could there be a cure for food allergies? A new study suggests there may be a way to either cure or greatly reduce the allergic reaction some children have to eggs. And the results were achieved by giving those kids eggs, or to be precise, egg powder. The results defy conventional wisdom about how and when foods like eggs should be introduced to children. In the hour ahead, we'll learn more about the study and what it means for the growing number of Americans who suffer from food allergies. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson in This Morning for Michael Krasny. For decades, the conventional wisdom has been that kids shouldn't be introduced to certain foods until they were 2 years old. The theory was that holding off on those foods helped avoid the development of allergies. But in recent years, scientific thinking has undergone a change. In fact, a new study of children with egg allergies found that kids who were given small amounts of egg white powder either got over their allergy altogether or greatly improved their egg tolerance. So in this hour forum, we want to look at the problem of food allergies in both children and in adults, why food allergies seem to be increasing in the United States, and what can be done to help those who suffer from them. Joining us this hour to talk about that, Dr. Scott Sicherer. He's chief of the Division of Pediatric Allergy and Immunology at the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, whose hospital was also part of this most recent study. Dr. Sicherer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Joining us as well here in our studio are Dr. Grace Yu. She is an allergist and immunologist at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation in Palo Alto, also part of the adjunct clinical faculty at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Yu, good morning.
Good morning.
And with us too is Mireille Schwartz. She is the founder and CEO of the Bay Area Allergy Advisory Board. Also deals with allergies herself as well as within her own family. Mireille Schwartz, good morning as well.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here.
Happy to have all of you here. Interesting topic, important one for millions of Americans. Dr. Sicherer, let's go through the basics of the study and what you found, because it is so counterintuitive at first blush. You think that the last thing you want to do with kids who have an allergy to eggs is to give them eggs. What did you do? Why did you do it? How did it turn out?
Okay, well, certainly the treatment for food allergy today still stands as avoiding the food to which you're allergic, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that later, but it's not just conventional wisdom, it's sort of common sense. If eating something is going to make you sick, then don't eat it. It's easier said than done, and we could talk about that, but the idea of this study was to really ask the question, can we do something to change the immune response to, in this case, egg, so that a child perhaps would be able to either ingest more of it or maybe even cure the allergy. Egg allergy is one of the more common allergies in childhood, and certainly avoiding egg is very, very tough to do. So in this study, what we tried to do is something that's similar to what people might be familiar with allergy shots. With, you know, someone who's allergic, let's say, to pollens for you know, more than decades, people have gotten allergy shots to the pollens, and it's basically giving them a little bit of what they're allergic to as an injection and gradually increasing that amount. And the immune system that used to, let's say, attack that pollen and give you hay fever from it or asthma would essentially learn to live with it and not attack it, and then you wouldn't have such symptoms when you're exposed to the pollen. The problem is that when that was tried for foods, injecting peanut was the example that went into the literature. People did get better. They were able to ingest more peanut, but they had way too many side effects from those injections. So people pretty much gave up on trying to inject foods. This is saying, well, gee, you know, if injecting it, maybe it gets right into the bloodstream as an issue. Maybe taking it orally will be somewhat safer, but still re-educate the immune system not to attack the food. And that's basically, it's a notion that's actually not new. This idea has actually been done here and there for over 100 years now in the medical literature. In this specific study, we took 55 children. This was a government-sponsored study. It's your tax dollars at work, the NIH, National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease. Five sites cooperating together here, doing a variety of different studies. But this study, each site had 11 children with egg allergy. This was what we call a randomized controlled trial, so that not everyone gets the real treatment, but the investigators and the people participating don't know who's getting what. And so essentially the bottom line is about 40 children would be getting the treatment and 15 would be getting a fake treatment, but we wouldn't know who's who with 11 at each site. So starting with a very tiny amount of egg protein in the form of a powder or maybe a placebo, the children would go through gradually increasing dosing over days and weeks and essentially months until they were on an amount that's equivalent to about a third of an egg. And after about 10 months of getting up there and being on that treatment, which they would continue to take at home, but every time we would give a dose, we would be doing that initially under supervision, medical supervision in the hospital, because people did and could have reactions. But for those who were able to get up to the amount that we were aiming for, they would stay on that for months. And then after 10 months in the study, we did what we call a feeding test, which is to actually go ahead and give them egg to see if they could have more of the egg. And it turned out that compared to the group that was on the fake treatment, they really didn't get anywhere. But the group that was on the real treatment, 55% of them were able to ingest what would amount to almost a whole egg.
And so the findings not only show you that it's possible to, in a sense, is it too strong a word to use the cure word? And if not cure, if nothing else, it raises the threshold, which is important in
right.
and of itself.
Well, you're absolutely right with your second comment. Raising the threshold is very important because it could make a difference between having an allergic reaction from an accidental ingestion or not when you're, for the most part, avoiding the food, which is what the general instruction is. But you can use the cure word in this study because the study was one of the rare studies out there right now that actually tried to find out if there was a cure. So what we did was, what I just mentioned, the children who were able, the 55% of children who were able to eat about almost a whole egg after 10 months of treatment, we kept treating them for longer. And after almost 2 years of treatment, 75% of them were actually able to get up to eating the equivalent of about an egg and a half, which is great. But then we said, well, gee, is this a cure? Is this a treatment that changes threshold? Because all of these children were basically on this daily dose of a third of an egg. So at that point, we took the children who were successful and had them stop taking their daily dose of a third of an egg for 6 weeks and then tried to give them egg again. And here's where it depends on if your cup is half full or half empty, but overall, 28% of the children were able to eat that amount of egg, that larger amount of egg, off of the therapy for 6 weeks. That's what I would look at as being a cure, because they weren't on a daily treatment anymore, and yet they held on to their ability to eat that much egg, which they were not able to do before. So you could look at it as 28% of them were cured, and 75% of the children had a remarkable increase in their threshold.
Dr. Scott Sisher at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. So Dr. Grace, is this concept then something that will really begin to change how allergies are treated in children?
Absolutely. This work that Dr. Sisher and his colleagues did is groundbreaking for the entire community of patients and families with food allergies. I absolutely agree with him and with all my colleagues who do research in this area that this is not ready for prime time in the community yet, because...
So you shouldn't do this at home.
I mean,
this is not something where you start giving out a little bit of egg to kids outside of a study situation.
Exactly. Having help start and staff exactly the same type of clinical research trial at Stanford, I know the rigors in which we do the dosing. We have a nutritionist and or a pharmacist measure out these minute doses of egg or peanut powder in a very, very careful scientific way. And you just can't have that level of sort of precision if you're just doing it at home. Actually, most of the children who are in these oral immunotherapy studies will have side effects. And, you know, what we need to do over time is increase the safety profile so that eventually something like this, and I'll be interested in getting more comments from my colleague, but, you know, eventually something, a modified version of this will be available for the rest of the community. But for now, it should be isolated to just research trials.
I want to hear from Mireille Schwartz in a moment about what that might mean for families like her, but come back to us, if you would, Dr. Sushir, on whether or not this idea applies beyond egg. I mean, if it works for eggs, can it work for peanuts, et cetera,
right,
et cetera?
So actually, although this study was unique in several ways, this concept has already been looked at for peanut, for milk. It's been looked at in different ways for egg. And actually, even some random other foods like fish and even kiwi have had this type of approach taken toward them in literature before. The problem is, and as Dr. Yu had pointed out, this has to be done in a very regimented way, and the only way to really figure out exactly what the risks and benefits are to do these types of studies in the way that this particular one was done, which is to include placebo treatment,
right,
so that you could see differences. As Dr. Yu mentioned, there was actually a high rate of allergic reactions to the treatment itself. Nothing serious, but it can be. And we certainly also saw that some of the children just had to leave the study because they had too many reactions. And so, you know, unfortunately, we're seeing that, you know, this is a serious approach that can trigger reactions, including anaphylaxis, severe allergic reactions. It's certainly not something to try at home, but it is something that can potentially, the approach itself, be applied to probably any food out there. And as Dr. Yu had intimated, there are other approaches that could be combined with this approach that might help to make it safer. There might be different dosing regimens that might improve the safety and the effectiveness. And probably very importantly, it would be, because we do have, you know, some really great results for a subset of the children in this study, for example, and other studies similarly, is there a way that we can identify before we go through all of this who would benefit the most?
Hmm.
If I could do a blood test that would say, well, you are going to have too many side effects, let's not even get started on this, or you are actually going to get cured from this approach, let's get going, that would really help a lot.
And Mireille Schwartz, give us the personal side of this. What has food allergies meant to you, to your daughter, so that we have some sense of what's at stake?
Absolutely. Well, I come from an atopic family, meaning that we are a family prone to food allergies. So with my mother, myself, and my brother, and then it has gone on to our respective children as well. So we live with and deal with these food allergy issues day to day. We don't know any other way of living. And we've been very curious about this oral challenge that the doctors have been performing. In fact, my daughter had been asked years back about doing one for peanut, her peanut
allergy.
That's
her allergy.
That's correct. So it becomes sort of this interesting dilemma versus whether you want to run the risk of living with this medical condition and the strict avoidance versus the dangers of engaging in a trial of this nature.
And how severe are the reactions to your for your daughter with peanut allergy? Because it's a hard thing to predict. Even if you've had a reaction one time, that doesn't necessarily mean it'll be the same the next, right?
Yeah. In fact, it's been my personal experience and our family's personal experience that no two food allergy reactions are ever the same. Each one of mine is different than the last, and the same with my family members as well. With my daughter in particular, we're quite hypervigilant still, although she's at an age where she lives her life normally and goes to school, camp, Disneyland, all the things that young people do. For myself, I feel that I'm pretty resigned to living with my medical condition, but I do have high hopes that my daughter's future may be quite different than mine.
Mireille Schwartz joins us. She's founder and CEO of the Bay Area Allergy Advisory Board. And say something about the work that you're doing in this arena, because part of the problem can be, especially if people don't have necessarily the best of insurance or have means, this isn't cheap to contend with these allergies.
No, it's certainly not. And what we do at the Bay Area Allergy Advisory Board is provide no-cost assistance to our Bay Area community. No one is ever turned away regardless of their income level. And we do a wide range of work. We promote education and awareness, and we also provide advocacy and in some cases medical financial assistance to the families in need.
How is this beginning to change, Scott Sasher, the overall question of when food should be introduced to children? I mentioned in the introduction the sort of conventional wisdom that you should hold off on giving kids certain things for fear of food allergies. Is that something that's changing?
Yeah, I think that the study that I was talking about earlier, where we're giving something the person is allergic to try to treat their allergy, has some relationships to your current question, but it's also a little bit different. So the idea of preventing allergy or food allergy by avoiding the food in a very young infant or even in the mother during pregnancy or breastfeeding, that has been a notion that's been around for a while and has really been essentially always controversial, but there have been recent studies that have changed our thinking even more. And to give you a very quick summary, there were some very early studies in the 80s showing that it appeared that children who were getting more solid foods earlier, especially those who were from families who were prone to allergy, as Ms. Schwartz's family is described, if they were giving their children more of these solid foods earlier or using a formula like a milk-based baby formula, they were seeing more allergic eczema, which is a kind of skin rash, also called atopic dermatitis. They were seeing more food allergies. So there was this notion that maybe giving these foods earlier or using a formula like that would be causing a problem, or at least not as good as waiting. So there were recommendations, for example, from the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2000 saying things such as a mother should consider avoiding peanut during pregnancy. She should consider, and this is not for all mothers, but for families with a family history of allergy, that during breastfeeding she might remove from her diet foods that are common to cause allergies like peanuts, fish, egg, milk. You can imagine that would be difficult for the nursing mother to do anyway. And then for the child, the instruction, and again, this is in the context of an allergic family history, that for the child, who might be perfectly healthy and fine, not to give milk until age 1, egg until age 2, peanuts, tree nuts, or fish until age 3. Now, those recommendations from 12 years ago were actually not based on any specific studies. They were just based on some notions from literature that was old. They were based on one series of studies actually out of California that showed that mothers who did a lot of those things, their children had less milk allergy and less eczema in the first year of life, but actually the children turned out to have just the same rates of all those issues when they were age 4 to 7. So having the mother do all those things didn't seem to make a permanent change anyway.
So what's a mother to do?
So in 2008, all of those recommendations and notions were rescinded. And some of the studies that resulted in a change in the thought process were one of the most influential ones, I think, is that there was a New England Journal of Medicine article in 2003 that looked at whether a mother's ingestion of peanut during pregnancy or breastfeeding had an outcome for peanut allergy, and it didn't. And then another study, which was more recent, looked at actually Jewish people in Israel and Jewish children in the U.K., in terms of the rate of peanut allergy, it was 10 times higher in the U.K. So the question is, well, what's different about the Jews in the U.K. versus the Jews in Israel? The main difference that the authors found was that the children in Israel were already eating peanut products before age 1, usually around 6 to 9 months, in a snack called Bomba, which is a peanut snack, whereas the children in the U.K. were, for the most part, not eating peanut until after age 1, so more often even after age 2, and they essentially had the same recommendations as we did to hold off on peanut and for even having the mother not eat it when she was pregnant or breastfeeding. Huh. So the question became, well, gee, maybe the idea that the immune system shouldn't see this because it's too young to see it should be revised with the idea that maybe it's good for the immune system to see it when the child is young.
So Grace, when you're talking with your patients, do you wind up trying to divide this up between whether there's a history, like there is with Mary Schwartz's family, mm-hmm. versus people in general, in terms of whether or not food should be introduced either to the pregnant mom or to a young child?
It's a great question. So In children who are higher risk, so a family member has a allergy, either food allergy or hay fever, or if there's a sibling with a food allergy, or if that child has moderate to severe eczema or very dry, itchy skin, those children are at higher risk of having food allergies. And I get this question all the time. And so I will screen, and this is just my practice, but this also is published by the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, that those children can be screened, or one can be a little bit more cautious because for instance, for peanut allergy, the first ingestion that you give a child by mouth can cause an allergic reaction. And we want to do everything we can to prevent an allergic reaction in higher risk children. So I will go ahead and screen those higher risk children prior to introduction of highly allergenic foods like peanuts, nuts, shellfish, fish, etc. For the children, though, exactly as you said, who don't have any family history of food allergies, who don't have atopic dermatitis, whose siblings do not have food allergies, I just tell them to go ahead and introduce foods as you normally do. So typically, ideally breastfeeding if they can for the first 4 to 6 months or longer if they wish, but 4 to 6 months. If they can't do that, then, just doing a cow's milk-based formula if they should so desire. But that in terms of if the child's family is not allergic or they're not at high risk, then they can just go ahead and introduce foods as they normally do with no restrictions on when to introduce cow's milk, egg, unless one is thinking about the development. So you're obviously not going to feed a child nuts like a peanut at 6 months of age because it's a choking hazard.
Right.
But smooth peanut butter is absolutely fine.
Dr. Grace Yu, an allergist and immunologist at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. We're going to open up our phone lines, take calls in just a few minutes. If you want to join us with a question about this interesting new study and science or about coping with food allergies, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can add your comments on our website or on our Facebook page. Mireille Schwartz, tell us how limiting this can be so that people have some sense who haven't had to contend with this as to what everyday life is like. What do you have to watch for that people might normally take for granted?
That's a great question. And that question is even bigger than you could imagine when you take into account the issue of cross-contamination, meaning the same fork or spoon that has been used to scoop, let's say, some peanut butter, like Dr. Yu had mentioned, in a restaurant or at a party, just even using the same spoon without properly washing and sanitizing it can also cause an allergic reaction, a full-blown anaphylactic reaction even. So it's a way of managing dialogue with the world around you. It's you always have to mention every time at every restaurant.
So every place you go.
That's correct.
Coming to the studio here this morning, you're going to think about, whether it's a cup of water or whatever.
Of course, you
have to sort of go through the history of all of that wherever you
go. Yes, you do. You have to think about the genesis of what's being handed to you at all times. So I like to think that us food allergic people are very good at multitasking.
Mireille Schwartz joining us along with Dr. Scott Shishur in New York and Dr. Grace Yu here in Palo Alto. Email question, and then we'll go to our break. Angela writes in, so when a mom breastfeeds, does that serve as a mechanism for passing on small doses of foods to the child? If a mom breastfeeds longer, are allergies less likely? So two questions. Why don't you start with the second one last? Because that's a typical belief that if you breastfeed, that protects. True?
I'm going to actually, if it's okay, I'm going to defer to Dr. Shishur regarding that question.
So unfortunately, there aren't really studies that specifically have looked at the outcome of food allergy with regard to breastfeeding length. So sometimes we think more is better. I think with breastfeeding, it's fine to continue breastfeeding. The question really comes more to the timing of exclusive. In other words, where do you start adding solid foods to the diet? And there have been recommendations about waiting to 6 months of age, and other recommendations have said 4 months.
Let me hold you there. Sorry, because we're going right into our break. We'll pick up on that question and all of yours. When we return, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson in today for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, food allergies and what can be done to solve that problem for people who must contend with them. Fascinating new study out about a way in which children may be helped in contending with egg allergies by just through a careful scientific process, being introduced to small amounts of eggs, building up a way in which their tolerance for eggs improves. Joining us to talk about this morning, Dr. Grace Yu. She's an allergist and immunologist at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. Mireille Schwartz, founder and CEO of the Bay Area Allergy Advisory Board, and Dr. Scott Schischerer at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. We want your calls about your issues in this regard. Join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can add your comments on our website or Facebook page. Scott Schischerer, I cut you off as you were halfway through your explanation of the question surrounding breastfeeding. Again, the question from Angela was twofold. If you breastfeed longer, does that mean allergies are less likely? And then whether or not this, then on the other side of that, though, might breast milk transmit small doses of allergens to kids?
So I'm going to answer that part in a quick way, which is we don't know for sure that longer is better, but part of the story is at what point do you introduce solid foods? And I think that the I'm going to answer this partly unscientifically with a gut response, which is, What happened before all of these allergy issues came up? And so if we think even to prehistoric times, I mean, there's no such thing as putting your baby under a cow to suck on them. And there was no such thing as a food company mushing things up and making them available in jars for your baby. And so, you know, what happened long, long ago? Mothers would breastfeed, and presumably they would give their babies food that are pre-masticated, meaning the mother would chew the food up and give the baby a mush from her own mouth. Now, I'm not advocating that we do that these days, but I think that what I'm trying to say is that somehow the body and the immune system developed or was made to be able to make that baby understand what the society was eating. Hmm. And it's true what the caller is saying, that what mothers ingest to some extent will come out in immunologically intact form into breast milk. But you could ask the question, does that make the baby allergic? Or you can ask the question, does that teach the baby what the society eats so they won't attack it?
So are you saying or suggesting in part, Dr. Schischerer, that this is a modern problem, that that's the reason why there's been an increase in food allergies?
There are a lot of theories as to how our modern lifestyle has resulted in increased allergy and other illnesses as well. And I'm going to give a little bit of a comment on this that answers this question and also goes back to a little bit of what Dr. Yu was mentioning before. For a child who otherwise is healthy and doesn't show any signs of a problem themselves, I tend to suggest to keep moving forward as is sort of natural to do. When I start to want to do testing, it's either because there was a very strong sibling risk of allergy, or whether there's a personal, usually just for peanut, or if there's a personal problem that's happened, like the child has had rashes from a food already, and then we start to worry about before we introduce the next allergenic food, maybe we should be checking on that child. But otherwise, a lot of the studies that are coming out now are saying that waiting longer on egg, waiting longer on peanut, waiting longer on milk might be counterproductive when there's nothing else going on that says you're supposed to be waiting.
Let's get to our calls. Suzette joins us first from Redwood City. Suzette, go ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this program. It was actually serendipitous that I just happened to turn it on this morning. My 5-year-old son has a severe egg allergy. He's anaphylactic to all forms of the egg, including egg baked into products in the most minute amounts. So my questions are, what was the age range of the subjects in your study, and was there a different level of efficacy based on age? And then how long before you would expect this to be used in a clinical setting?
Thanks. Dr. Schischerer.
So the children that we looked at were age 5 to 11, and the reason for that is that most young children do outgrow their egg allergy, luckily. Obviously, people who, like yourself, might be in a different category than that if there's been so much going on. But we looked at children in that age group because they should be holding on to their allergy for a while longer, and we felt that that was the better treatment group. We didn't see significant differences, within that age range, but it was a fairly narrow age range. And in terms of when to expect this to be used by your corner allergist, I really am hesitant to make a guess at that. But what has to happen is large-scale trials of this food and others, on the aggressive side, I would be hoping that this would be in just a few more years from now, but I can never make promises on that because we don't know what we're going to find as we study this more.
Suzette, thanks so much for the call. A number of people are writing in about the question of whether or not it's also, this is also sort of counterintuitive, but whether or not we're too clean. Jennifer writes in about whether or not allergies might have to do with using certain kinds of soaps. And Wendy writes that, this is on our Facebook page, that children, she's read that children brought up with pets and in homes that are not spick and span actually have fewer allergies. So are we too clean, Dr. Susher?
So this goes back to, I mentioned before, that there are a lot of theories about why there might be an increase in allergy. And the top theory is what's called the hygiene or cleanliness hypothesis. Before I mention much more about it, I don't think any of your listeners should be on a guilt trip like, oh my gosh, I used too much soap or something like that. But as a society, we're living with smaller family size and cleaner environments, so to speak. We're not living on the farm anymore where you would be exposed to natural dirts and manure and things like that. We're not living in parasitized areas, jungles or whatnot, where our immune system has to battle those types of germs. And we're doing a lot of things that have improved our health. And so antibiotics, vaccinations, these have all kept children from getting horrible illnesses, from dying, and all of that is good, and I would never want your listeners to think, oh, gee, I better stop vaccinating, or I better stop using antibiotic when I need to, and things like that. But what it's telling us is that since the immune system is causing this problem, we can ask, well, if the immune system is supposed to be attacking all these other germs, and now it's not, maybe it's looking for a fight and is accidentally attacking otherwise harmless proteins like those in foods or pollens or animal danders.
And this might also be the reason why there's another new study out that shows that there are more allergies in cities than in rural areas, that in rural areas perhaps you develop more of those.
There have been tons of studies like that, and also looking, again, even at the pets in the home or the number of children in the home. And, you know, so all of there is a pretty good body of literature saying that that's the difference. And that's actually one of the research areas to try to figure out, can we safely stimulate the immune system in a way that would make it less likely to cause allergies. So people are looking at things like probiotics, which are good bacteria, or looking at actually giving people a type of parasite that doesn't make them sick but would at least stimulate that part of the immune system. So that's ongoing research.
So, Mira Schwartz, how do you deal with this? Because you have to actually be hypervigilant about cleanliness and washing everything. So how do you – or does this idea of somehow sort of gently exposing to develop more antibodies, or does that just not fit into what your particular situation is?
Well, I do give a lot of credence to the hygiene hypothesis, but, I mean, it's a dirty world, and we have to all live our lives. I do think that the body naturally will fight against what it needs to, and if you don't stimulate that area, I think the body may get lazy in that respect and find another thing to attack or do. Nonetheless, I think in our particular situation, we do need to keep things very clean of the allergens. But I don't find that dog dander, pet dander, or just playing in the playground, for example, harmful. I think those are great things to do.
Wendy on our website writes in, can your guest comment on the differences between food allergies, sensitivities, and intolerances? My family suffers from a wide range of sensitivities, but thankfully not full-blown allergies. Again, this gets to the question, Mira Schwartz, of how varied all of this is, that you can't necessarily predict or say with any degree of specificity, if you have this allergy, you're going to suffer in this particular way.
Oh, absolutely. Each is quite different. I think the issue of the intolerance, and I can also defer this to Dr. Yu, is that is more of a gut reaction that takes place in your intestines, whereas there's nothing quite like an anaphylactic reaction that hits you on every level. Orally, your body breaks out into hives, your blood pressure drops. It's quite different than an actual just an intolerance, which may just affect your digestive system.
It's a great question. So I deal with this all the time in clinic, the difference between food allergy, which is a reproducible immune-mediated, and we like to think of it as mediated by the allergy antibody, and it's an abnormal or aberrant response to normally a harmless protein like peanut protein. And exactly as Mirai mentioned, it has wide manifestations, anywhere from just a little bit of mild itchy skin or a little bit of itchy mouth, all the way to breathing problems and blood pressure problems.
And does that mean, Dr. Yu, that the person who has a mild response one day can mm-hmm. have an acute response the next?
It's a great question. So every reaction can be different. It depends on the amount of the food allergen that's eaten. It depends on the state of the immune system at that time, if one has become more allergic over time. It depends on whether another allergen that somebody's allergic to has been co-ingested at the same time. It can depend on preparation of the food. For instance, a lot of children who are allergic to eggs and milk can tolerate, thankfully, baked egg and baked milk because the baked egg and baked milk has been degraded by the heating process, so the immune system no longer recognizes it. So every reaction can be different.
Are there things, Dr. Yu, that you can do, as Dr. Shishir was beginning to describe, that can sort of strengthen you, almost like, you know, getting more fit, so that even though you still have a particular allergy, let's say it's peanuts, that through eating yogurt or doing other things to sort of become more fit or have a stronger immune system, that would help modify that in some way? Does that make any sense?
It's a very, very interesting question, and I'm curious to hear what Dr. Shishir has to say about it. I think it's always important to have overall good general health, get enough sleep and exercise, et cetera. But I think that in terms of – I have family members who have food allergies, many, many patients with food allergies in my practice. And in terms of avoiding a food allergic reaction, the most important thing is strict avoidance in carrying an EpiPen, TwinPak, and an antihistamine with you at all times. Now, we do know in the oral immunotherapy food allergy research trials that a child may be taking the same dose of, say, egg white powder or peanut powder, but if they catch a viral infection like a cold, or they go out and exercise and get their heart rate up, that even though they were able to tolerate the same dose before, that stimulation of the immune system by that virus or exercise can boost the immune system too, could trigger an allergic reaction in those children. So going back to your question, I think good health is, you know, sleeping well and getting good nutrition, but for standard of care, still strict avoidance in carrying the EpiPen.
And to Anne in Arinda next. Anne, go ahead.
Hi. I was diagnosed with something called a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth in January, and then a few months after that, I was diagnosed with a slew of food allergies to really very basic foods like bananas and beef and avocados. And I've been reading the listservs, and the listservs actually recommend following something called the specific carbohydrate diet or the gut and psychology syndrome diet. And they recommend those two things as avenues towards actually curing the allergies. And I was wondering if you guys had experience with allergies actually being cured based on following a specific diet.
Dr. Shishir or Dr. Yu, either. Weigh in, please. No one wants to?
I guess we both felt silent. I mean, the bottom line is that the way I look at it is if there was something that was definitely a cure out there, we'd all be using it.
Yeah.
And that's probably all I can say on that.
There are a couple of people, though, are also writing in, and stay with us, about diet overall, like whether or not having animals fed with more genetically modified food being introduced into the world, whether or those things are playing a role, whether diet plays a role in the development of allergies.
You know, I would follow up with that and with what Dr. Yu was saying to say that there are, you know, some studies out there that have some interesting comments to make just about our general diet. So, for example, there was a study, a large study that looked at pregnant women's diets and the outcomes in their infants. And they looked at foods like milk, egg, peanut, but they also looked at fish. They looked at margarine in the diet, and they came up with showing that the children whose mothers had less fish and more margarine had more allergic issues, skin issues in this particular study, than those who ate more fish. And it didn't matter whether they were eating more or less egg or peanut or tree nut. So, you know, what that came back to was that there are healthier fats in the fish and unhealthy fats in the margarines, and that was probably the reason for the differences in the children. It goes back to what was sort of generically described as a healthier diet as being, you know, a good idea. And if we think back again to that prehistoric person versus some of the things that we eat nowadays, you know, that could definitely play a part. Another sort of theory about increase in allergy is called the vitamin D theory, that, you know, we are protecting ourselves from sunlight more, which is a good idea for cancer, but that's how our body gets vitamin D, and there seems to be some relationship to reduced vitamin D and an increased risk for allergic problems.
And sorry, we're not able to provide much more specific help. Is there anything else you want to follow up with while we've got our two doctors here on the line with you?
No, that's it. Thank you for the
show. Okay. All right. Thanks, Ann. Let's go next to Sheila in Oakland. Sheila, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Very good show. I appreciate it. I have two questions. First one is, although the airlines are not serving peanuts these days anymore, most of them, but they don't take any responsibility in asking passengers not to eat peanuts. Many passengers carry their own peanuts. Last time I had a flight with my son who's severely allergic to peanuts, I had to ask personally every passenger not to open up the peanuts they had with them.
Wow.
Interestingly, three people in the row right behind us and in front of us had their peanut bags with them and told us they won't open it. My first question is, what can we do to change the law to protect the environment for people with allergies like my son? People with disabilities can get, you know, to different places on airlines, but they put the burden on people with allergies and say, it's your responsibility. Don't take
the
flight.
Thank
don't
you,
take
Sheila.
The risk.
Yeah, no.
My second...
Hang on. Before you get to your second question, I'd like Mireille Schwartz to respond, because this is the kind of thing that you deal with personally, but also within your organization.
That's correct. In fact, last summer we had a scenario where we were contacted by a client who had purchased 13 tickets for a family reunion in Hawaii. And during the course of, after purchasing the tickets, during the course of a conversation with the airline on the telephone, the conversation escalated and escalated regarding this particular topic until they were placed onto the do not fly list, having already purchased the tickets with no refund offered. So we were asked as an organization to mediate on behalf of the family, which we did very successfully. And they did wind up being able to travel, and it was incident-free. But these are certainly hot-button topics. And
is there a movement, an advocacy movement for people with allergies to deal with the kind of problem that Sheila is describing?
Absolutely. It can be difficult. And I think that sometimes it's tone and context is everything with this type of conversation.
And Sheila, just your second question, but briefly, please.
I would like to raise the threshold of my son specifically for this problem. My plan is to open a jar of peanuts at the back of the kitchen and have him exposed just to the smell. I wonder if I should let him know or not.
Sheila, thanks. Our guests in the studio are shaking their heads. Dr. Shashir, you want to weigh in as well?
Uh-oh. I don't know if they're shaking their heads up or down.
Shaking no.
So, I think that, you know, every patient is their own story, so to speak, and so someone who's living with this should really discuss with their own allergist what the concerns are with what I term as casual contact. So being in a room with something, touching something, smelling something, being kissed, all those issues are definitely things that should be discussed with your allergist. I'll kind of throw in that my bias is that a lot of times these kind of concerns have a huge impact on quality of life, and for many people with the allergy, it doesn't have to. I'll kind of leave it there, but that's why I think you have to talk to your allergist.
Yeah, Doctor, you weigh in as well, please.
I completely agree with what Dr. Shashir said.
Okay, Sheila, so be careful and talk to your allergist is the recommendation here. Let's go to Morgan next in San Francisco. Morgan, go ahead.
I was wondering if you are familiar with a technique called NAET, NAMPAD, Allergy Elimination Technique. It uses acupuncture points using sound vibrations to break up patterns in the body and to eliminate food and chemical allergies.
Okay, Morgan, thank you. Dr. Yu?
I am familiar with that technique because one of my patients has tried it. And when they brought it up with me, I went ahead and looked through the research literature to see if there was any scientific studies that showed that it helped cure or ameliorate food allergies. Unfortunately, there were no scientific studies to show that that it helped. So I feel bad saying that, ideally, you would want to choose a treatment option that is evidence-based, and that's why Dr. Sisher and our colleagues around the country are doing these trials to try and find a cure.
Yeah, Dr. Sisher, you want to comment on that or anything else out there that you're beginning to investigate?
Yeah, I think Dr., you covered that well. It's on the list of those approaches. There are many of them that are considered unproven and experimental or disproven by the expert panel from the government that has looked at them. I think it goes back to my comment earlier. If there's something that worked and worked that well, we'd all be using it. So it's buyer beware on that. Grounds. But we are looking at many different approaches, and I'm not against alternative therapies. In fact, we're looking at a Chinese herbal remedy, which is actually currently being looked at several sites now. It was developed by a colleague of mine here at Mount Sinai, Dr. Shu-Min Lee. It depends on where your perspective is. The Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, is called medicine in China. It doesn't have the extra words. So, we're seeing some very interesting things in the laboratory with this and that are very promising, and we're in safety studies and some efficacy studies now and looking to do more. So I don't have anything against some of these, what some people might consider non-traditional, but they have to be looked at scientifically. They have to be looked at with safety in mind who it's being applied for. So that's an exciting thing. There's a treatment called anti-IgE, which is an injection that basically attaches to and sort of inactivates one of the proteins that causes a lot of problems in allergy. Using that in combination with the oral immunotherapy is one approach that we and others, including Dr. Yu's group, are looking at. We're looking at some different ways of administering allergens. So, for example, maybe there are routes that are even better than the mouth. And so is there a way of doing this through skin or some other means? And the other thing I mentioned earlier in the program was about allergy shots. Allergy shots weren't done for food allergy because too many side effects. But what if you took some of these proteins and changed them in a way that they may not cause a severe reaction from being a shot? So that's something else.
Lots out there. And just staying with the question of traditional approaches for a moment, because, of course, Chinese medicine or medicine, as Dr. Sisher noted, are being looked at for lots of conditions and diseases now. And here's one that may or may not relate to that, but it's important to realize that a lot of those have a lot of validity possibilities to them. Andy writes, and what about local honey? Can that help with hay fever, or is that an old wives' tale?
It's so funny you ask that, because I was at the farmer's market with my husband 2 years ago, and he saw local honey being advertised as a cure for hay fever, and he was so excited. Yeah, he showed it to me, and I said, honey, unfortunately, I don't think that this is going to be a cure for food allergies, or I'm sorry, for hay fever. The reason why is because bees typically pollinate flowering plants, and the types of plants that tend to cause hay fever symptoms, like itchy eyes, itchy nose, those are wind-pollinated plants, like ragweed, olive trees, oak tree, etc. Those are not the flowering plants in general. And so it's very unlikely, just from a mechanistic standpoint, unfortunately, that bee pollen would cure hay fever.
Here's the question about genetics. And Mira Schwartz, why don't you just take it first, and then Dr. Yu, you can chime in. Randy writes in, is there a genetic component to allergies? My wife is allergic to seafood. So what is the likelihood that that will pass on to our children? You come from a family where things have been passed on.
Oh, that's correct. Absolutely. So I would imagine that. I believe the research that I had read up on was that if one parent is food allergic, there would be only a 30% chance that the child might be born with a food allergy. But if both the parents are food allergic, I believe the numbers go up even from there.
Dr. Yu?
So In terms of sibling risk, so if one sibling is allergic to peanuts, there's about 7% risk that the other child will be allergic to peanuts. So there definitely is a genetic component. And even in what we call monozygotic twins, meaning identical twins who share exactly the same genes, there's a 67% chance of concordance, meaning that both of them will have peanut allergy. So there is definitely a genetic component, but there are environmental factors, just as Dr. Shisher had mentioned, that probably play a role in the development of food allergies as well. A
couple of people writing in, Dr. Shisher, about whether or not one can outgrow allergies. You commented on that earlier, but Melissa writes in that her daughter is 14 months old, is intolerant to milk or milk product through her breast milk, wondering if that's the kind of thing that can be outgrown.
So the good news is that most of the food allergies that children will develop, like to milk, egg, wheat, or soy, are outgrown during childhood. It might take a while. It might happen even in the teenage years, but it usually happens. So you're looking at over 80-85%. For peanuts, even, it's not necessarily a lifetime thing, but it's much more persistent. So only about 20% of very young children outgrow peanut allergy, and for tree nuts, it's about 10%. We don't have good numbers for fish and shellfish, but it's probably also in the range of more in the 10% type of range. One thing I wanted to mention, so I don't miss out on this, is that there was a lot of interest in these studies and clinical trials, and people live in different areas. Sometimes it's hard to find a place nearby that's doing these. I would suggest to look at www.clinicaltrials.gov, which is basically a database of all sorts of clinical trials, and you can search for food allergy in various ways and look for trials near you.
Let's spend our last moment or two just providing people with some additional resource information. For people in the Bay Area here, Mirai Schwartz, and who are having trouble, whether it's with the airlines or in affording an EpiPen, what kind of assistance can be provided?
Well, no one has ever turned away from our organization, and we receive a very wide range of requests, and we tackle them all.
And how do people contact you?
They can contact us at www.allergysf.com.
So www.allergysf.com.
SF, like San Francisco, yes.
And Grace, you for other sources of information. Is there a sort of go-to place where people can find out how to contend with these issues?
Absolutely. I think the Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network, which is online, they also send out a newsletter every 2 months, which I must be honest, every time I get that newsletter, I learn something from it because parents and families write articles about their experiences with food allergies. I think that newsletter and the website and getting involved in your local community is all fantastic in terms of really empowering yourself to cope with the food allergies, which can be life-changing.
I'll just throw out that the address for the Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network, it's www.foodallergy.org. And I would also recommend the Food Allergy Initiative, which is FAIUSA.org. And lastly, our group is part of this consortium of food allergy research. So it's www.COF, like Friday, AR group, all one word, .org. And there's free educational material on that website as
well. All right. We'll try to get those on our website as well. A lot of letters to keep track of. But thanks all so much for providing all your expertise this morning, Dr. Scott Sischer, Mirai Schwartz, and Grace Yu. Thanks all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Vinny Tong. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. Our interns are Asal Asanapur, Jessica Young, Emily Holtzman, Shelby Pope, and Joshua Rafman. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.